What does it take to be an entrepreneur, and how is it changing in our ever-evolving business landscape? This is Scott Galloway, host of the Prof G Podcast and an entrepreneur myself. Right now, we've got a special three-part series running all about the future of entrepreneurship. We're answering your questions on work-life balance, how to raise capital for your business, and more. Because when you're an entrepreneur, it's always important to look ahead at what's to come. So tune in to the Future of Entrepreneurship, a Prof G Pod special sponsored by Mercury. You can find it on the Prof G Pod feed or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Friday night post-game edition of the Talking About podcast. I'm Sean Kennedy. Joining me on the line this week is Jackson Frank of Liberty Ballers. Jackson and I are going to talk about the extremely disappointing 102-101 loss for the Sixers at home against the Clippers. Sixers had a 24-point lead in the second half, and real shades of the Atlanta series blowing a 20-some-point lead at home. Jackson, what happened in that second half that the Sixers blew this one?
Yeah, I mean, I think in general, that entire game, they had no way to score if Joel wasn't involved. Right now they're really, really short on wing depth, and the Clippers are flooding wing depth. You know, they've got Amir Coffey out there and he's been impressive despite the fact that Paul George and Kawhi Leonard aren't there. You know, Marcus Morris has been great, but he can play as well. I did a rough calculation toward the end of the game. This could be off. So, someone corrects me, that's totally fine. But by my calculations, Joel was involved with 55 of the 78 points the Sixers scored when he played, which means they scored 23 in the 11 minutes he didn't, which is not terrible, but I think 55 to 78 is probably not a great balance you want. You don't want your superstar to be involved in over, I think it's about 70% of the offense. Maybe you want him involved in 70% of possessions, but you don't want him to directly influence that many possessions. And so just no real way to score if Joel wasn't a factor. George Niang, 3 of 11, missed a lot of good looks, especially early. Tyrese Maxey got off to a good start, but I think he was 2 of 8 after I think he was 5 of 10 in the first half and then 2 of 8 after that. Obviously, the final shot was not really his fault. You just got to do what you can do with that play. Yeah. But yeah, just that. And then, I don't know exactly when they were up 24, but early in the third. And then, that bench unit kind of turned on, autopilot a little bit defensively as well. For some reason, they had Furkan Korkmaz at the point of attack. And I know they're limited right now. They're without Ben Simmons, of course, but also Matisse Thybulle, Danny Green. You don't have a lot of great options to play there, but that didn't work either. And so it was just a weird game. It got tense toward the end, but it felt like there was a 10 to 12 minute stretch where I felt like I was kind of going through the motions. I could tell the Sixers were. So strange game, but yeah, they just kind of, they took their foot off the gas pedal, which is a cliche, but it was because they couldn't score without Joel and they couldn't get stops, on the perimeter, especially.
Yeah, you mentioned Niang having a tough shooting night. He and Korkmaz combined to shoot 2 of 13 from 3, and Isaiah Joe 1 of 4. So those kind of secondary guys that are in there just to hit shots and are getting open looks, they just weren't falling tonight. And we should mention Joel had 40 points. He, another superstar performance, to be sure, 6 assists. He did have a few costly turnovers down the stretch, so it wasn't his most.
Yeah, I thought this was probably his least great passing game in a little while. Sometimes his high turnover count comes from just maybe a little overzealous dribbling, but he had a couple of skip passes intercepted. So,
the bad turnover at the top of the key with a few minutes left. Not his cleanest performance, and yet 40 with 13 rebounds and 6 assists. That should be enough to win a game.
We're nitpicking. And even that turnover, I think, that happened. And I kind of wonder, I rewatched to kind of see what it was. And nobody really gave him help, right? It was that, that play kind of felt emblematic. He had the ball at the top of the key, two guys doubled him, and everyone else just kind of stood in the corner in the wing. So, of course, I'm not saying that Joel was the reason they were playing poorly, but he's had so many good games that it is, worthwhile to mention the other passing wasn't as sharp as it's been, despite some awesome reads nonetheless from him.
Yeah, even in crunch time, he had an amazing sequence that looked like he was going to pull their fat out of the fire. He made this incredible behind the back pass to Charlie Brown under the basket, which if that's Matisse Thybulle, you figure that's a dunk and the Sixers might win this game. But Charlie Brown puts up this little 3-foot floater shot that is just one of the most awkward shots in basketball for anyone to try to make, and it doesn't go in. And then Embiid gets a bit of revenge on the other end. He makes this incredible block of Zubac at the rim to get it just before it would have been a goaltend, blocks it away, and then he hits a three on the other end, and you're like, all right, well, he looks like he's single-handedly going to do everything, but it wasn't quite enough. And as you mentioned, Sixers caught a bit of a break in the final seconds with Marcus Morris missing both free throws, but then Tyrese Maxey had a pretty good look. He had a floater attempt with at the buzzer, but stuck in the rim, which was a apt metaphor for the Sixers offense outside
of
Embiid. That play
was weird to me because, like, not just the outcome, but I was like, I don't know, maybe I need to rewatch the play, but I didn't feel like there was much of a plan. And I feel like if you know that you're calling your last time out pretty, they didn't call it at the 2 minute mark. They probably called it 30 seconds, maybe on the right before the Joel dunk, if I recall, his final bucket. Like, you would think that you would drop something, right? And I just, they didn't. You know, it's tough to go the full length of the floor in 5 seconds, but it didn't feel like there was much of a plan there. It just kind of felt like, let's get the ball in the hands of our best ball handler, who's also really fast, and see what he can do. And it just, and especially like the fact that they got to take the ball to bounds. Like, obviously they lost about 4 seconds with that scrum, but I would wonder, like, why isn't there a play where Joel's sitting up on the left block and he has, get in the ball and just see what he can do with a post turnaround, a fadeaway, something like that. So, obviously I'm not blaming any of the players, but I was just confused. I felt like they were a little ill prepared from the coaching staff's perspective, because you had called a timeout, pretty recently, and you should know that, like, he might have taken the ball out of bounds to tie the game or win the game. And so that was just confusing. It wasn't Maxey's fault they didn't get the ball too well, but you would have thought that maybe they would have had some contingency plan to get him the ball, considering he was 15 of 25 and, air from the field in terms of mid-range jumpers as of late too.
Yeah, that's fair. In their defense, they might have assumed they would have had like 9 seconds left to pull something off. And maybe you mentioned the scramble that burned about 4 seconds off. And there was a lot of confusion in whether the Sixers would even get the ball, because the Clippers actually recovered it, but they were on the baseline. So they were deemed out of bounds. So it wasn't the most straightforward sequence. So
maybe less of a criticism and more just like a point to note, maybe that I was considered, I guess. I don't know. It's important to note that it was a weird play. And honestly, like, after Morris missed the first one, I was thinking to myself, like, the Clippers are going to get, he's going to miss a second, they're going to get the rebound, right? They did get the rebound, but they ran out of 94 feet. So, but yeah, I agree. That's a fair point. The things were thrown out of whack when, four dudes hit the floor for 3 seconds.
Yeah. I mean, that's, you were definitely right to worry about that, because once again, the defensive rebounding was a bit of a problem for the Sixers. The Clippers had a big offensive rebound down the stretch to get a second chance opportunity that kind of put them back in the lead with a couple minutes left. Just something that's been an issue for the Sixers all season. But pivoting to the Clippers real quick, they had 7 guys in double figures, a really balanced offensive attack. Reggie Jackson led them with 19, but it was pretty evenly distributed throughout their roster. You're on the West Coast, so you probably watched more Clippers games than maybe a lot of Sixers fans have. What do you think they did well tonight? Because they are a team that's, as you said, missing Paul George and Kawhi Leonard, but they showed a lot of heart to come back from down 24. They easily could have just chalked this one up as a, hey, we're on the East Coast, it's a tough road loss, like, we're just, waited to the next game to turn it up. But they never gave up. They kept fighting. And these are the games that, as a Sixers fan, you say, how did you lose that one? But if you're someone rooting for the Clippers, this could be something that maybe gives management the go-ahead to not be sellers at the deadline, or just, I don't know. What did you see from them that they did well tonight?
Yeah, I mean, their defense is really phenomenal. I know PG's played maybe 60% of the year, but they're really well organized on that end. They still have good defenders and guys like Isaiah Hartenstein, Ivica Zubac. Nick Batum was awesome tonight. He did a great job. I mean, I know Joel got his numbers, but he did a great job of limiting how often Joel could get the ball, and that in itself is a win. They came in tonight's game with a 6th-ranked defense. As I mentioned, Paul George has played roughly half the season. Kawhi has missed all of it. So they're just really, like, as I mentioned, they have a bunch of wings out there that they can throw, you know, throw on the fold. Amir Coffey has been impressive on both ends, you know, since he entered the rotation. I don't know exactly when, but last maybe 3 weeks or so when I've caught Clippers games, he's popped in some ways. Eric Bledsoe can drive you nuts offensively, but he can still play some defense. Terrence Mann, you know, has some size and physicality and ability to move on the perimeter with some strength. So that's going to impress me most this year, is they're just really well organized on that end. And you saw that be the case. You know, the Sixers kind of went away from Joel working in the mid post the last maybe 18 minutes of that game. And that's because the Clippers decided to front Joel and bring help on the backside. And as we know, the Sixers aren't very good at making entry passes. And it's even tougher when you have 2 6'8", 6'9" long wings, you know, deterring you from making that pass at all. So I was just really impressed with the defense. And that's what really, really stood out to me most of the year, is they just, you know, the offense can be pretty tough to watch. And that's going to be the case when you're without your two wing star creators. But the defense is really well coached and they execute well, you know, in addition. So that was definitely the case. And, like, you know, again, Joel was awesome. I'm not going to say otherwise, but it didn't quite feel like some of the great Joel games we've seen this year, in the sense that, like, every possession the defense was in rotation because of what he offers. And that was because the Sixers couldn't get him a touch every possession. There were stretches where they didn't. And so that's much, you know, it's partly an indictment of the Sixers ball handlers, but it's also a testament to what the Clippers did defensively to limit how often he even got the ball. Cause once he got the ball, it was kind of a wrap for the Clippers.
Yeah. I mean, anytime he got it against Zubac or Hartenstein down low, it was either a foul or he was getting his. But you're right. He definitely had to work for it a lot more than Wednesday night, when everything just seemed effortless. Like everything he was doing was taking his maximum effort. But it, to be fair to the Sixers, you know, no Seth Curry in this one, who's typically their secondary scoring option. They're missing the wings like Matisse and Danny Green that they've been missing for a bit. So you're pretty limited as far as where else they can turn. Do you think they could have done anything differently as far as generating offense? I mean, Tyrese Maxey had 18 shot attempts, but still feels like he sometimes gets sidelined for long stretches of the game and he's just kind of like off in a corner. Do you feel like they're doing enough to get him involved with the ball in his hands at this point?
Yeah. So a couple points. One, I think it's absolutely fair to bring up that, you know, like the Sixers are down 5 rotation players. Like, however you deem Ben Simmons, whatever, like the fact of the matter is he is on the roster. He is a max level player who's been an all-star 3 years in a row and he's not playing. Then they're without Shake Milton, Danny Green, Matisse Style, Seth Curry, as you mentioned. Like yes, the Clippers are without guys, but the Sixers are also down some players. So I always try to kind of caution that. I like my stance is I think the Sixers are very good when they're healthy this year, even without Ben Simmons, but they're not healthy even without Ben Simmons. So that's always important to note as well. There are obviously issues, but I actually thought Maxey was pretty well involved in this one. In general, I agree that, like, you know, there are times where he just sits in the corner. Like in the start of the year, there were times he was in the dunker spot. They've kind of, you know, drifted away from that. But I thought he was pretty well involved, and they ran a lot of high pick and rolls or high pick and pops, whatever you want to call that play where Joel kind of floats to the free throw line. And so I thought that was encouraging to see. Like it seemed like Tobias was more of the third option in this game. And if you're a Sixers fan or you're a Tyrese Maxey supporter, that's what you want to see. You want to see Tobias kind of being the third option. And so that was good. But yeah, I don't really have a great, like, yeah, I think a lot of times there's always a way the Sixers can do things better, but in this one, you know, they shot well from three overall, but two, you know, it was a lot of it was buoyed by the fact that Joel and Tyrese went 6 of 9 combined from three. You know, Tobias only a couple of threes, Furkan 1 of 6. He's still been in kind of a year long slump. As we mentioned earlier, Niang 1 of 7. He's a guy who shot about 38-39% from three on the year. So not a lot stood out to me. I'd have to go back and rewatch it, honestly, I think. But it's just, you know, it's just the reality that they're down 5 rotation players from a team that, you know, for all of its faults last year was pretty dang good. And, you know, yeah, you'd want to win that game when you have Joel Embiid, who's overwhelmingly the best player in it. But they're at a tough spot where you're starting Isaiah Joe. He's not in the rotation. As much as I've enjoyed Furkan Korkmaz, he has not played like a rotation level guy this year, unfortunately. Charlie Brown Jr., it gives you a lot defensively, but that guy's got to sit in the gym and do mic and drills for the amount of layups. He's probably he's missed what, 3 or 4 layups off of knife passes from drill the last few games. So
yeah, it seems like there's 2 every game that he's wide open from 5 feet in and it just right off the rim.
Yeah. So, I mean, I just like, I don't know. I'm someone who, I think if people have followed me long enough, my coverage of the team, I'm generally a little more tepid, but I just feel like this team is good when it has its full complement of players available. I know the Clippers don't either, but I don't think there was a lot more they could have done other than the guys executing better. And, you know, a lot of these guys are overextended. Furkan had to play at the point of attack. He was probably given too many ball handling responsibilities. So I don't think this team, you know, even at full strength without Ben, is like a championship contender, but I just keep kind of offering the caveat that they're missing a lot of guys too. They're not, you know, this team just, you know, the way Tobias has played this year, unfortunately, this team is like not that good outside of Joel. And when you take away three or four or five of the rotation guys, you're in a tough spot regardless of what the opponent looks like. And that was the case. Of course, you know, you win the game if Furkan's 4 of 7 instead of 2 of 7, and you know, Niang is 5 of 11 instead of 3 of 11. But you know, schematically, I don't feel like there were a lot of issues beyond that last play of the game that I mentioned earlier.
Yeah, maybe the answer is just that Niang, Korkmaz, and Joe have to shoot better than 3 of 17 from three, and you'll be all right. But yeah, I mean, it's fair. I think the fact that they blew a 24-point lead is going to lead to a lot more skies falling discussions than if they had just been in a close game with the Clippers throughout the night and happened to lose. You might say like, oh well, that can happen. You're missing a handful of starters. You know, it's the NBA. Everybody can get anybody on any given night. I think that blowing the huge lead is just what might lead people to overreact to this loss.
Yeah, I think if I could just add a caveat in general, the thing that I would kind of latch onto, if you're looking for something to like tangibly worry about, it would just be the over-reliance of Joel. Like that, even if Seth plays, even if Danny plays, Matisse, whoever it is, this team is still going to rely a ton on Joel offensively. And that doesn't change if those guys are in. And I think, you know, as I mentioned earlier, like they don't have a guy on the perimeter as a ball handler who can take two hard dribbles and create a really easy lane to get Joel the ball. They struggle against ball pressure. We've seen it at times where like they have a 10-point lead with 4 minutes to go, the defense ratchets it up, and all of a sudden it's a 1-point game. And so I think that's kind of the broad issue with this team, is it continues to ask so much of Joel. And that's been the case since, you know, Joel was a rookie. Obviously he's developed into a guy this year who is pretty dang capable of it, but you know, that's a longstanding worry. But that is kind of more independent of this game and just the general, you know, kind of flaws in this roster that have been there for years at this point. But this game, yeah, I don't, nothing stands out to me that I like that was pressing that we didn't know about this team before and that hasn't been there for years. But I guess you could say like maybe if Seth Curry plays, you get a little more diversity because, you know, they don't really have that two-man game. Just, you know, Furkan, I think, just doesn't have great chemistry with Joel in that two-man game. He had a little bit better with, it seemed like, Ben last year in that transition especially. But yeah, this game doesn't really change my opinion of the Sixers beyond kind of everything we already knew about this team. And that's, they're limited and they don't have as much talent as they would prefer, in large part because Tobias has struggled and Ben Simmons hasn't played a game for them. That's, you're working from a pretty big deficit at that point.
You certainly are, and you are right to point out that they rely a ton on Joel Embiid. Some might argue that makes him an MVP candidate, and you made that argument in an article earlier this week for basketballnews.com. We're going to talk about that, but first we're going to take a quick break to hear from our sponsors.
What does it take to be an entrepreneur, and how is it changing in our ever-evolving business landscape? This is Scott Galloway, host of the Prop G Podcast and an entrepreneur myself. Right now, we've got a special 3-part series running all about the future of entrepreneurship. We're answering your questions on work-life balance, how to raise capital for your business, and more. Because when you're an entrepreneur, it's always important to look ahead at what's to come. So tune in to the Future of Entrepreneurship, a Prop G Pod special sponsored by Mercury. You can find it on the Prop G Pod feed or wherever you get your podcasts.
You ready?
Showtime.
On May 3rd, summer starts with the Fall Guy.
Let's do it later.
Let's drink a spicy margarita.
Make some bad decisions.
Yes.
Audiences are falling in love with the most entertaining film of the year.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy?
Fall Guy.
That's what the poster said.
See Ryan Gosling and Emily Blunt in the movie critics say exists to make you happy.
Trying to make it out?
Nope.
Because I don't either. It's not what I'm into right now.
What are you into?
Talking.
Yeah.
The Fall Guy. Only in theaters May 3rd. Rated PG-13.
All right, so Jackson and I are going to talk Joel Embiid. He has been incredible since coming back from his COVID absence in late November, early December. Jackson, you wrote earlier this week, basketballnews.com, great article everybody should check out about how Joel has, coming off a MVP runner-up season, I guess people might have assumed, okay, this is the ceiling, but he somehow surpassed expectations and done even more this season and raised his level of play to a whole nother caliber. In your mind, what has he most done this year to expand his game and, you know, take things to the next level from where he was a year ago?
Yeah. I mean, like, if I'm being fully honest, if you would have asked me before the year, like, is Joel better or worse than he was the previous year, I probably would have said, a little worse, probably about the same, but I think he's like absolutely been better. I'm sure the metrics probably are kind of a push, but just having watched basically every game he's played the last 2 years, I feel like I'm pretty well equipped to look at the eye test to an extent. But what stands out to me is the fact that I think his composure is at a new level this year, and that kind of bleeds into his general decision making. I felt like last year, and I kind of include this in the column, and it's probably a little outdated at this point because of updated numbers, and Joel's had a really efficient week these three games. I think he's got like 130 points in three games or something.
But, yeah, we should mention his 50 points in 27 minutes against the Magic was the ninth highest point per minute total in NBA history. So that probably did jack up his efficiency a bit for the season.
Yeah, and I think he had 32 against the Wizards and 40 against the Clippers, so he's averaging like a clean 40.7 or something. My math is correct there quickly. Yeah. This week, but coming into the game, and he was about 60% true shooting, which relative to league average was about 4.5 points above, whereas last year was 6.5. But he was only at 41% from mid-range. Last year was at 47%. 41 is much more in line with his career numbers. But he's still been able to be pretty close to last year's efficiency because of the composure. There's just not really a way to speed him up these days. I think back to maybe those first 2 or 3 years in the league for Joel, where if you double teamed him, especially if you sent a double late when he kind of got into his move, he would, you know, he would force a shot. He would throw an errant pass. He would go from this giant 7-footer who can see everything on the floor to, you know, 6'2" guard who's getting swarmed by two players. That doesn't happen anymore. He keeps his dribble alive more. He's able to attack before the double team comes. His interior passing has improved. I don't know, you know, I think we saw some of that develop a little bit Ben's rookie year, but since then it's been a little bit dormant. Has great chemistry with Matisse in that dunker spot role. We mentioned some passes against the Clippers. You know, he seems to be finding guys more often kind of when they cut. Last year, he really got that skip pass down to the corners. Now he's added the interior shovel pass, whatever you want to call it. And I also think he's kind of improved as an off-ball scorer a little bit. Like he just feels more decisive, especially the last 3 or 4 weeks. They're kind of using him as a pick-and-pop guy, and he's got the nice – he'll catch the ball in the wing, and he'll kind of pass fake into a drive. We saw a couple of those against the Clippers, a couple against the Magic as well. So it's just minor things. The screening's been better as well. I think the screen's been a little more inconsistent the last couple of weeks. But I feel like generally he's been better about kind of actually creating space for guys when they run those side pick and rolls. I think he had a play in the fourth quarter against the Clippers where he set a good screen for Maxey, forced a switch, had Eric Bledsoe on him, and then Bledsoe tried to front him. They got the ball to the wing and they threw the ball to Joel, easy dunk. So something like that where, you know, he doesn't get the assist, but he's the one scoring and creating the play. So I think there are cliches that people talk about, but it's true with Joel. He doesn't get sped up, and there are reasons for it, like I mentioned, and that's just the key. You know, I just watch him, and he just has so many counters. You know, if the defense leaves a little bit of room on that double team, he'll step through to the middle for the Hakeem-esque fadeaway that he likes in the middle. He'll go baseline a lot too to beat the double before it can come. He's not rattled against late help that really buried him, I think, even last year at times. So, just really, really impressive. And then obviously the shot making has kind of come around since he returned from COVID. I think he's almost up to 40% from three again after his 3-of-3 night. You know, he's approaching 50-40-80, which is ridiculous for any player, let alone a guy like Joel who does everything he does inside of the free throw line on defense. So,
and the volume too.
Yeah, absolutely. So the biggest thing I would just say is the composure and patience. And he just reached a level to go from a guy who was an all NBA caliber guy who could get sped up against certain defensive schemes to you can't really stop him these days. And I mean, you know, I think generally everyone, you know, was pretty much, you know, resigned to that fact, but you'll still see people who are like, oh, they played this team or this opponent. And it's like, he's played like 19 different teams since he came back from COVID. Like at some point it's just, nobody can stop him. And,
yeah.
So that's what stood out to me the most. It just feels like last year he was great and it was fueled by the shot making. This year it feels like he's been great and it's kind of shot making and the way he processes the game coming together. And I think that's a lot harder. You can always kind of benefit from better shot making. And I'm sure Joel deserves praise for improving his shot making, but the processing, you know, kind of right in his prime is really, really impressive to see that take a leap.
Yeah. It's been 6 weeks now of him just getting 30 points a night as if it was as easy as breathing. Like it just seems to come like, oh, Joel's playing tonight. He's going to get 30. He might get more, but that's the floor for him. So I don't know who these hypothetical defenders are that are out there that Joel hasn't gone up against that would purportedly slow him down, but.
And I could be strawmanning, to be fair. I want to be fair. Maybe I'm reading to old criticisms, but yeah, I agree that, you know, I mean, look at Silva. We're at, you know, played his 10th game of the year about 2 months ago. And since then he's averaging, I think about, you know, this played 25 games since coming back from COVID. He's averaging about 31. So yeah, I mean.
Quite impressive. You hit on a lot of the key points. I think the passing, his recognitions, the double team coming and getting those interior looks down to Matisse, or it's been Charlie Brown the last couple of games, finding those guys underneath the basket has been much improved from previous years. The other thing I would mention is the grab and go stuff. It seems like there's at least one play a night where he goes coast to coast himself and it's just this unstoppable freight train. He had another one against the Clippers tonight, it's just watching a man that big move that purposely down the court. It's just amazing to watch. And it's just like he decided one day, like, okay, I can do this now. So I'm just going to do it whenever I can. And it's just another, it's like he's in a video game and he gets this attribute that he can just add to his icon. And now it's suddenly available for him whenever he needs it. It's incredible to watch him.
What I think is most impressive about that part of his game, which is certainly a point that needs to be recognized. I should have had the piece in front of me, honestly. There's so many different things he's improved at this year. But what's impressive is his body control and his kind of discretion on those plays. It doesn't feel like he gets himself into bad spots very often. And that can happen a lot. I think, you know, these are clearly different caliber players, but someone who got to do that a lot last year and is a big man is someone like Domantas Sabonis. And obviously, again, they're different, but like Sabonis would kind of dribble his way into tough spots sometimes. Obviously, he's smaller, doesn't have the length of Joel, but Joel never really gets into bad spots on those plays. It feels like they don't score every time, but he doesn't get stuck where he's spinning around or pivoting around and then gets a three in the key or forces a pass. And so the body control, the patience, you know, the discretion is really impressive. I think also the teammates around him deserve credit for filling the lane so well. Tobias does well to fill the corners a lot too. Tobias has his issues when he's leading the break at times, but I think off the ball, he's good. Maxie does a good job. Shake, Matisse, all of them. And so I just, that part came to mind to me when I watched that Joel dunk against the Clippers tonight, where it was like, he's leading the break. Four guys are flanking him, but they're not, you know, not running interference on him. And so obviously most of the credit goes to Joel, but an effective transition game, you know, requires all five guys being on the same page. And that can be tough. And it's not like it's something Joel has dabbled in for 4 years. We saw some of it last year, but Ben Simmons is largely the guy leading those breaks. And, you know, it's become Joel, and Ben was a different type of player, right? He was largely kind of a pass first guy on the break, and it worked a lot, but it's testament to everyone involved for kind of enabling those grab and go sequences that are so fun and effective.
Yeah. I was going to mention that's a good point. And that Ben, having been the guy that did those plays for all the years he's been with the team, that probably enabled other guys to get accustomed to filling those lanes. And Joel and Ben aren't doing the same things on those breaks, but their roles are pretty similar when that guy gets it and you have this point center type person just grabbing and going, and you know to just get to your spots down the court. So they certainly have experience flanking a star leading the break like that. So right now, Embiid, depending on where you're looking, he's either like a plus 500 or plus 600, right around with Nikola Jokic, and then Steph Curry and Giannis are the two favorites. I don't know where you would, if you had to put your money on an MVP candidate, you can tell me if you have a clear opinion, but if you don't, what would you say the argument would be for Joel if you were making an MVP case for him?
Yeah. So, I mean, it's a really fun debate because right now I think there are six players who kind of been in their own tier. That would be, you know, this is not in any order, so Sixers fans don't come at me. It would be Jokic, Steph, Giannis, KD, LeBron, and Embiid. KD is going to fall out, unfortunately, because he's, you know, slated to miss at least, I think, 3 more weeks with a knee sprain or maybe an MCL sprain, I don't recall exactly. Something is needed.
About 4 weeks or so. Yeah.
This is 4 to 6. I think then he injured himself last Saturday, Sunday. So that's unfortunate. But right now, my MVP, I think, would be Jokic, maybe Giannis, my top, but Joel would be third. And I think he's coming on strong. The Sixers have a pretty hellish February and March. So a lot of it's going to come down to that. Like, I mean, if they lose a lot of games, which could happen. I mean, they're playing good teams, and I don't know what their health is going to look like. We don't know if they have players in place of Ben Simmons. Maybe improbably all of a sudden they have Ben Simmons, but which is, you know, a very emphasis on the improbable part there. But that, I think that will determine kind of, you know, what Joel's candidacy looks like. I think they're going to have to be within, you know, a 47, 48 win team in a minimum. I think they can be, because as I said, like when Joel plays, I think, you know, after tonight, there may be a 55 win pace. I think they were 57 win pace before the game. They were 23-10, now they're 23-11. But they also have good, I mean, they've had a lot of easy schedule, easy games, but they also have good wins. Bulls, you know, Bulls a couple times, Nets, Warriors, like they've won all those games with Joel playing. So
I think Celtics that Heat back to back last week was a good stretch for them.
Yeah, you know, obviously the Heat were, I think they're without Lowry and, or they're at Bam, excuse me, not Lowry. But still, I mean, the Sixers were without guys. I think, you know, I don't think Danny played because Danny Gunn's here in the Celtics. Matisse didn't play. So still it's an impressive win. Yeah, I think the Heat game is worth mentioning. Those five I mentioned, though, were just kind of the classic that had gotten in my brain for about a month now. But it's a good point as well that the Heat one can be added to the repertoire. So I think that's really going to determine it. But I think Joel absolutely has a case. And I don't want to jinx anything. I'm going to knock on wood here just for his sake and whatnot. But, like, he also has only missed 2 games besides COVID. And that's really impressive. I think he's played 25 out of 26 games now since returning. He missed that Grizzlies game, but that's it. And so, like, if he plays 71, 72, you know, that was one of the big issues last year. Like, I probably preferred Jokic last year, but if they played the same amount of games, and I think Jokic played all of them, it would have been a really, really tight discussion. I still preferred Jokic. I might have, again, like, and so that sort of thing matters. It seems like Joel is a guy who could end up playing 70 games or 68 versus the 61, 62. And, you know, I don't think it's like a huge deal, 8 games there, but voters seem to fixate on that sometimes. So I don't think I'd pick Joel to win, but I think he's absolutely in the conversation. And the way he's trending, like, I mean, if you're talking about, like, whose stock do you want to buy? Like, Jokic has been great, you know, Giannis has been great, but, like, I think it's, you have a great case to say that Embiid has the best stock right now, just the way he's played over the last 2 months. So I would give it to Jokic. I know that they don't have a great record, but everything he does in conjunction with his improved defense, I think, would kind of give him the nod. And just, you know, just the reality, he's played, you know, about 5 more games than Joel. But I think that can change. I'm not, by no means am I saying that, like, it's locked in stone or written in stone that Joel can't win. And so I'm just really impressed with him and all these guys, really. You know, I was talking with Paul Hudrick the other day on his podcast. It's cool how we have these 6 guys right now who are kind of the best players this year, and they're all different, right? You know, I think that's really cool. And you can kind of see shades of Joel's game in all of them. And I think you can kind of see that. And all, you could make that case if we're talking about from every specific superstar's lens. But I think Joel is squarely in that conversation. And right now, if I was saying who are my 3 finalists, I think Joel would be my 3rd guy. And the fact that I'm picking him over a Steph Curry, a KD, a LeBron, you know, is a testament to how flipping good he is this year. And the fact that he's put his team in a position to have a record that's good enough to warrant it. I don't subscribe to the record thing as much, but it does matter. And, you know, 26-19 is probably good enough. And that's because Joel has been awesome in the 34 games he's played.
Yep. Having a guy who you might consider top three is not a bad place to be by any stretch of the imagination. So yeah, it's all splitting hairs when you get to this certain tier of players. I mean, you can make the case for any of them depending on what stats you look at or whether you want to build a narrative case for someone. And yeah, you said the games played often comes into it. And I think oftentimes that just becomes like an easy out for people that they don't want to have to make a hard decision. So you can say, well, he's available for 10% more games than the other guy, so clearly that was more impactful, which there's fairness in that statement. I'm not saying you should discount that, but sometimes I just feel like that just becomes an easy way out for some voters. But yeah, if Joel can, you know, stay healthy, and I think that's been an under-discussed thing this year, how his conditioning has been incredible and the two-way lift he's having to do for this team right now, and the fact that those DMP rest days just haven't really been there this year. That's been really good to see, and it bodes well not only for this season, but you know, into the future, that people kind of always assumed the injury specter would hang over him perpetually, but we haven't seen that as much this year. So yeah, hopefully that can continue in the future. And you know, you never want to take it for granted, but it looks good at the moment.
And I would just add too that, like, if someone wanted to make Joel their MVP right now, I would have no issue with it, especially because it's a really weird situation where it wasn't like Joel had a bone bruise and missed, you know, 2 weeks. He's a guy who was vaccinated and had a serious bout with COVID. Like, you can never control injuries, but I think this is this is a year to be even more lenient about missed games, because it's like, you know, like it's entirely out of his control, right? Yeah. Like,
it wiped out half the roster.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Yeah, that. And so, like, you know, and that's not to say that if Joel missed 11 games with some other injury that, you know, I would be less receptive to it. But that's just to me, that I prefer Jokic and Giannis, but I don't have any issue if someone prefers Joel. And I get it, because it's like, if you're a Sixers fan, you're probably watching every game of his, or maybe catching Jokic or Giannis when they're on ESPN or TNT. Mm-hmm. I totally get it if you watch him every night and you think he's the MVP, because he's playing like it. And that's not to demean anyone. I'm not trying to say that, but, like, you know, and as you mentioned, everyone values different things too. I'm really excited for this MVP race when it comes down to the end of the regular season, and I kind of sit down and actually, you know, flesh it out, and I expect Joel to be there. And so I'm just, you know, just noting that I don't necessarily think Joel would be my pick right now, but I'm not going to scoff by any means at someone who prefers him and disagrees with me, because he's been that good. And we've reached a point where I don't even have words for him. Sometimes I'll always keep notes, obviously, when I watch him, but sometimes it's like, you know, I've seen this play from him now 46 times on the year. Like, what am I going to glean from, you know, writing that down?
He's very good at basketball.
I feel like that's, you know, I didn't do much Joel analysis, but I said like one tweet today, despite of having 40, and it was most of the, it was just like, yeah, he's really good. And we all know it. And that's about that. And that's, you know, and so it's cool that he continues to be in the MVP race. And Sixers fans are just really fortunate. And as just someone who loves basketball, I'm fortunate to get to watch him, you know, three or four times a week. And that's not the case with every person who covers a team. And so it's just been a joy to watch him. And, you know, the Sixers are in a really, I would say pretty good spot with him at the helm, despite everything else, you know, going around them. You feel that they have a good chance to win every game, you know, when he suits up. And as you mentioned, he's, you know, suited up for most games outside of his, you know, unfortunate, you know, 3 week absence with COVID.
So that was a top of a conversation when Daryl Morey did a radio interview earlier this week for 97.5 with Mike Missinelli. He mentioned how having Joel playing the way he's playing, you know, gives you a shot of contention. And he said he would probably peg it at around 5%, and it's not as high as he would like. And they should be outside. He considers them outside the top five where he would like to be, but still having a guy like Joel, it gives you a chance. So what do you do when you have a guy and you have that chance? And he spoke about largely about the Ben Simmons situation and where he said it's probably less likely that he'll be traded at the deadline than not. And that him and his team are doing everything possible to work every angle and make every phone call to make it happen. But it just doesn't seem like the perfect deal is there right now. And there were a lot of other things that he covered in that, which I would encourage people to read Dave Early's piece on our site that covered it in depth. But Jackson, I wanted to ask you, what were your takeaways from Daryl's recent public statements?
Yeah, it was interesting. It was really insightful. You know, I think that's one of the cool things about, you know, Daryl's a GM. Obviously, you know, people can feel however they feel about Daryl's GM person, whatever it is. You know, I certainly have my own, you know, opinions there, but I think Daryl is pretty insightful about things when he makes public appearances, and, you know, someone who covers a team, I appreciate that. You know, a lot of GMs will be kind of, you know, keep their cards close to the chest, which is totally reasonable as well. But just in terms of pure enjoyment, I like that Daryl is not afraid to speak his mind.
You could argue that drove one former Sixers GM out of his job was his desire to keep things close to the vest.
Yeah, there you go. Yes, maybe I shouldn't be praising Clip. Maybe if you want to keep a job, I guess. Maybe. Daryl's had a pretty good run here as, you know, executive for quite a few years. But, you know, a few things stood out to me, and I talked about those Paul as well on the pod yesterday on Thursday. But that 5% comment really stood out to me because he was featured in a Grantland article, I think almost a decade ago at this point. I think Zach Lowe wrote it about the fact that if you have at least a 5% chance of winning a title, which is a select few number of teams every year, you kind of have to go for it. And he said that he feels the Sixers are a team that has, you know, at least a 5% chance. And so to me, that signifies they're going to do all they can to improve the team around Joel. And even if it's not the ideal move, you know, for Ben Simmons, that I just feel like that was a pretty strong indicator. And then just how open he was discussing kind of, you know, Sacramento as a trade partner was fascinating to me. I think broadening the criteria from top 30 to 40 is interesting. And then apologies if anyone listened to the pod with me and Paul, you're going to hear a lot of the same talking points. But I think top 30, when you talk about all-star caliber, can be a little more rigid and well-defined because you say either the guy's an all-star or he's about to be an all-star or he's not, right? There's a little less, it's a little more binary. Top 40, there's an X10 set of players who can be anyone, right? Like, I mean, obviously there's can't be anyone, but you know, it's pretty widely up to interpretation. Like if the Sixers acquire player X, Daryl can say, well, we ran this number and we see this thing and we see his fit with Joel and we view him as a top 40 impact player in this context. And maybe you don't agree with that, but you know, it's Daryl the one determining what a top 40 guy is. And so those two comments specifically really stood out to me. I just feel like a trade is going to happen. I didn't think it was going to happen prior to his radio appearance, but those two things right there just really resonated with me. And it feels like Daryl realizes how dominant Joel is and how good they are. I'm sure they know, you know, like the back of their hand, their record and net rating and all those things when Joel plays and the wins they have. And so, and they're looking at the climate of the league where you have, you know, the Nets are in a weird position. The Bucks look good, but also Brooke Lopez has been injured. The Bulls have some things going on. They're also kind of a first year core. The Cavs are awesome, but they're young. The Heat are good, but like, do they have enough firepower to really be definitively better than the Sixers? And so all of that combined, I just feel like a move gets made. And I think there's enough out there that, you know, you're not going to find a star. I don't think you're not going to find a guy that you're like, oh yeah, he's unequivocally, you know, an all-star alongside Joel for the next 3 years. But I think you're going to find guys that you can upgrade talent. You know, they need help on the wing. They need help at backup guard. You know, I mentioned Shake Milton's absence earlier. I mentioned Furkan Korkmaz's struggles. Those aren't two backup guards you feel great about going to the playoffs with. And so you look at a team like the Kings who have, you know, two or three guards available and, you know, a wing like, you know, like Harrison Barnes and maybe even have interest in Tobias Harris. I just feel like a deal gets done. And if you want to go back to the top 40 thing, and I think Daryl also talked about the fact that it might be like a three-team deal. Like it might not just be a two-teamer. People always say multi-team deal and I'm like, every trade is a multi-team deal. But I think like you could say that John Collins is a top 40 player. I don't know. I would say he's probably a top 50 guy, but you could, I mean, we're splitting hairs there at that point. Right. So If we're looking at a three-teamer there, I just feel like there's so much smoke around the Hawks, the Kings, the Sixers. All of them look like they're primed to do something around the deadline. And so I think those comments were pretty insightful. And to me, they indicated that they realize how good Joel is. And even if they're not going to get a Dame Lillard or Bradley Beal or Zach LaVine and James Harden back, that might not be imperative to win a title or at least be a title caliber team around Joel, given the way he's played this year.
Yeah, the thing that stuck out to me was him talking about the top 40 guy and also mentioning like you could use that as a step up trade. He kind of alluded to down the road, and he specifically mentioned it being like a young guy that could then be enticing to other teams. So this was a common thing in Sixers Twitter and everywhere else, but it just seemed like Tyrese Halliburton was describing him. It was like playing guess who and doing everything you could to describe a person without saying the person.
Well, didn't he compare him to like a caliber of Maxie's, like a player of Maxie's caliber? Yeah, and like same first name, same draft, like,
right?
Same age. Like, come on, like be a little more discreet, Daryl.
Yeah. A guy like Tyrese, cough, 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 Maxie. He couldn't have been more obvious. So it did seem like that. And he was just saying to Vivek and King's management, just, hey, ask for a little bit less. And this is good. Like, just putting the screws to them a little bit in a public forum, which, hey, I'm okay with. A Halliburton center deal, I'm very much on board with. I think that would help the Sixers both in the present and set them up well in the future. I'm good with that. And the only cause for concern I had was that he mentioned he still feels it's less likely. He's still doing the, like, will Ben Simmons come back and play this year if we don't do the deal? We have everything we need is a Ben Simmons sized hole. Like, we need defense, we need playmaking, we need rebounding. He's the perfect pairing for Joel Embiid. Is that just, hey, I'm doing everything to maintain his trade value I can, even if everyone recognizes that that's a sham? Is that just, you know?
Yeah. It to me, it just felt like posturing, like, hey, like, you may hear that we're on the 4-yard line with the Kings, but like, you know, we feel like Ben might still come back. And so, feel free to throw your best offer at us. If you want to kind of get to the 3-yard line with us, then by all means go for it. But like, I never want to overstate, you know, like how an executive thinks or how much I feel like I can get them. But I can't get the idea that Daryl watches this team and thinks that the missing piece is Ben. I think Ben would help them. Like, obviously he's a good player. Like, feel however you want about him. The defense would benefit from the transition game, but like, they need a half court ball handler and a guy who can shoot off the dribble or a guy who can attack off the catch with Joel. And that's not Ben. Like, So to me, it just felt like posturing. It felt like, you know, like, Ben, we think you could help us. And if we can't find a deal, then we would love to have you back. Like, I think we're well past that point. Obviously everyone who's followed this situation feels that way, I'd imagine, but yeah, I can't feel like that was an honest part of his radio. Because I've watched every team this game's played this year, every game this team played, excuse me. And I don't feel like the Ben archetype is exactly what I'm missing. Yes, a player who's very talented and good would help them, because as I said earlier, they're a little short on talent. But
yeah, they only have like 7 of their rotation guys a lot of nights.
Yeah.
So yeah, another one would be helpful.
Yeah, they had like 7, like 14 guys on rotation this year, and 6 or 7 are available right now. But I don't think the missing piece is Ben. Maybe the ideal version of Ben that everyone's thought of for 4 or 5 years now, but we've never seen that guy really beyond maybe the end of his rookie year and some of those Joel list games in the 2019-20 year before Ben got injured himself. So I just can't, that just feels like posturing to me. It really does. I think again, Ben would help, but it's not the archetype that would solve everything for them, because like, even if Joel is as good as he was last year and they have this roster, like, I don't think all of a sudden they're coasting to the finals. I think they would be better, but I don't feel like that archetype is exactly what they're missing. So I feel Daryl is shrewd enough as a basketball mind to see the glaring holes of the team, not of which are all Ben Simmons sized.
Yeah, the magical 16 game winning streak to end the 2018 regular season. That's the Ben that's in everyone's minds. Yeah, no, I agree. It definitely, if you're hoping for a trade to happen by February 10th, I think there was a lot of positivity you could take away from that, those comments. I think despite Daryl saying it's less likely than it is to happen, that I think people can be encouraged. Then I feel like after hearing that, I'm more inclined to think it's going to happen than I was going into it. So good stuff. If you are hoping that Ben Simmons has a new uniform come mid-February, as I think 98% of Philadelphia Sixers fans are at this point. So Jackson, thanks for your insight on that. And thanks for speaking with me this evening. Unfortunately, I wish it hadn't been following a 24-point blown lead, but that's the way it goes sometimes, unfortunately, with this team. So we can find your stuff on Liberty Ballers, but where else? I know you're involved in any number of things. Where can people find you on social media, and where else can they find your work on the interwebs?
Yeah, appreciate having me on, and I agree that, you know, it would have been cool to talk about Joel in a winning sequence or winning format, but felt a little fair to talk about Joel and doing it all and coming up short as a team. So you can find me on Twitter at @JackFrank_JJF. Most of my Sixers analysis is in game or, you know, on podcasts like these or a little bit on Liberty Ballers, but general NBA analysis, I'm doing a lot of stuff on there, a lot of clips and whatnot, and then my work written or otherwise is at Basketball News, Dime Up Rocks, and The Analyst, and then as well, Sixers coverage at Liberty Ballers. Appreciate having me on, Sean. I'm sure we'll be talking Sixers again soon with you or Paul or, you know, audio, whoever it is. And, you know, I imagine it will somehow involve Joel Embiid being very good and the rest of the team, you know, either performing up to par or falling short. That's the way it goes under the Joel Embiid tenure these days.
Yes. The one constant is Joel Embiid playing well, fortunately. So we do have that. All right. So for everyone listening, I'm Sean Kennedy. You can find me at Philly Fast Break on Twitter. I tweet much less frequently than Jackson and much less insightfully. I do what my 3-month-old son allows. So thanks, Jackson, again for coming on. And for everyone else, I'll talk to you next Friday.
What does it take to be an entrepreneur, and how is it changing in our ever-evolving business landscape? This is Scott Galloway, host of the Prop G Podcast and an entrepreneur myself. Right now, we've got a special 3-part series running all about the future of entrepreneurship. We're answering your questions on work-life balance, how to raise capital for your business, and more. Because when you're an entrepreneur, it's always important to look ahead at what's to come. So tune in to the Future of Entrepreneurship, a Prop G Pod special sponsored by Mercury. You can find it on the Prop G Pod feed or wherever you get your podcasts.